Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now. A federal judge in Texas has suspended a rule from the Obama administration that would extend overtime pay to millions of American workers. The rule was set to take effect on December 1st, but the judge decided that the Obama administration had overstepped its authority. Ali Velshi is an MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. He joins us now from New York. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Peter.
Well, so a lot of people, depending on this rule, we're talking retail workers, food service workers, people who work at nonprofits. So just a quick reminder, Ali, what it was supposed to do.
$23,000 was the threshold below which, if you earned that, you would have to get overtime if you worked beyond the number of hours a week, probably 40, that you were supposed to. The Obama administration wanted to increase that, wanted to double it to around $47,000 a year. That has now been not struck down, but suspended by this Texas
right.
judge.
And what was the Obama administration's justification for doing this? Just in being in solidarity with this broader conversation we're having for, say, a fight for $15 minimum wage?
Yeah, well, it's not unrelated to that. This cap hasn't been increased since 2004, and the Obama administration has taken the same view of it as it has of minimum wage, that it's time for a catch-up for wage-earning Americans. There was a sense in the Obama administration that this very low $23,000 threshold was letting companies get away with paying people not very much money, but, you know, just enough that they didn't have to pay them overtime.
And this judge in Texas, what did he see as the overstep?
Well, in suspending the rule, the judge in this case, who happens to be an Obama appointee, he wasn't commenting on the validity of the underlying legislation or on the process of increasing the threshold below which workers are entitled to overtime. It was a narrow legal challenge about both the scope of the increase from 23,000 to double that and the methodology.
Well, what were some of the businesses who would have to deal with this rule? What were they thinking? Take through some of the concerns that they had, because I understand that some of them were looking for ways around the rule.
Yeah, well, so that's an ongoing discussion anytime you discuss something that potentially increases wages. Both the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the National Retail Federation, you mentioned retailers, were part of the lawsuit against this measure. They argued that it was punitive to business and might, in fact, result in less employment. Now, that's not an economically airtight argument, because increased salaries to low-income earners are shown to go directly back into the economy. They almost act as a stimulus by increasing demand. Think of it this way. If you earn $30,000 or $40,000, your extra money doesn't tend to get put into an investment. It gets spent. But that's hard to make the case to the company that has to pay the higher salary. They're saying that it's just non-competitive if we have to suddenly increase the amount we pay people.
Yeah, and yet for months, companies across the country had been preparing for this rule to take effect. I mean, just in a couple of days, it was going to happen.
Yeah.
There were scheduling systems in place that were changing. There were whole changes to the HR system. So, well, what does this mean for them? They sort of now have to all of a sudden put on the brakes and turn around the other direction.
Well, for small companies, it's really annoying to have to change things, because they don't have sometimes big HR organizations or the software to handle it. But in some companies, particularly larger companies that would have been affected, in anticipation of this rule going through, they actually raised some workers to slightly above the proposed overtime threshold, $47,476. They assumed that it would save them some money rather than having to pay them overtime. So it's unclear whether they will roll those increases back, but it's definitely put everybody into a state of flux. And also, the rule hasn't been struck down. It's just been suspended, so we don't know where it goes.
Right. Those companies that had already made changes to their employees' salary, giving them a raise.
Yes.
I mean, you can't imagine them just deciding then to take that money away. That's a very complicated situation.
No, so you would imagine that they would be on the side of, hey, let's keep this rule going, because what they don't want to find is that they gave people a raise, their competitors didn't, and can now undercut them because they're able to pay workers less money for making similar products or offering similar services.
Well, as you say, this is a conversation that's going to keep going in the courts. But regardless of what happens there, you've got to wonder if it's the beginning of the end for another another reason, because Donald Trump, I mean, just this week, he promised to roll back regulation in that video that he came out with. He said that for every one new rule that was put into place, he'd roll back two more. So, I mean, what do you think? Is the regulation just going to be reversed when Donald Trump takes the White House?
Well, first of all, that one back for two back for one more is a little arbitrary. So I'm not quite sure how that's going to work. But typically, Republicans don't warm to this sort of rule. However, Donald Trump did happen to win on the back of working Americans who feel hard done by. So it's unclear how he would handle this rule politically, which very clearly benefits low-wage American workers. It's not clear that it benefits their employers, but it's very clear that it benefits them. So it's not 100% clear that Donald Trump would have rolled this back. The Labor Department, you know, says, as one always says when you lose a legal challenge, that we're examining all our options. But I think they're not going to do anything until they find out what Donald Trump's Labor Department is going to do about this.
MSNBC's Ali Velshi, thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, dozens of major cities in the U.S. are standing by their status as sanctuaries for people in the country illegally. This move comes as President-elect Donald Trump vows to cut federal funds to so-called sanctuary cities in his first 100 days. But the definition of sanctuary differs from place to place. Today, let's look at what it means to be a sanctuary community in the Washington, D.C. area. Armando Truhl from Here and Now contributor WAMU reports.
This protest by young immigration activists from the Washington, D.C. area was aimed not at Donald Trump, but at the city's mayor, Muriel Bowser. The group caught up with her outside an event and demanded a stronger statement of support for sanctuary. But what is a sanctuary city? Bowser says in D.C., it means telling police and other city employees not to cooperate with federal immigration officials. She says the election won't change that.
The district wants our law enforcement officers to focus on helping and protecting and serving D.C. residents, no matter their immigration status.
The concept of offering sanctuary goes back to the 1980s, when American religious groups gave refuge to people from Guatemala and El Salvador who were fleeing civil unrest.
In today's context, the way it's being used now is cities that are not willing to cooperate fully with the federal government in immigration law enforcement.
That's Doris Meisner, senior fellow at the Migration Policy Institute, a centrist think tank that studies immigration issues. She says there are hundreds of these so-called sanctuary cities.
It turns out that about 53% of the unauthorized population in the country lives in those jurisdictions. That's about 5.9 million people.
In the Washington, D.C. area, police in the district, along with Montgomery and Prince George's counties, don't participate in immigration raids unless they're part of larger criminal cases. Officers don't ask the immigration status of victims, witnesses, or suspects. Corrections officials in the district and Prince George's don't notify immigration authorities when undocumented immigrants are arrested. And Montgomery County does so only if the person has been arrested for violence, weapons, or drugs. But none of these jurisdictions hold undocumented immigrants past their release dates, so immigration can take them into custody for deportation. Prince William County in Virginia does comply with these requests and allows its officers to act as immigration enforcers. That's according to Republican Corey Stewart, chairman of the county's Board of Supervisors.
We actually aggressively seek to identify those illegal aliens who have committed a crime in our county. We initiate the deportation process under the 287G program, and then we hand those criminal illegal aliens over to federal authorities for deportation.
Stewart says more than 7,000 people have been deported from Prince William County since 2007. But studies show about half of those deported under 287G are involved in misdemeanors and non-serious offenses. Nevertheless, Stewart, a former chairman of Trump's campaign in Virginia, says cities and counties should comply with all immigration requests or face the consequences.
If local authorities are aware that someone they have apprehended is here illegally, they should inform federal authorities, specifically Immigration and Customs Enforcement, that they have that person detained And if they don't do so, then I would consider that locality a sanctuary city and a locality that should be sanctioned probably by the withdrawal of federal funding.
Defenders of sanctuary cities say pulling federal money isn't right because the federal government requests immigration assistance. It's not required. Prince George's County Executive Rashern Baker says his police department complies with federal laws.
And if anyone, including the Trump administration or anyone, tried to remove federal funds from Prince George's County that's helping us, that our tax dollars go toward, we certainly would turn to our representatives at the federal level and insist that not happen and fight it vigorously. And we'd expect the state, the governor, and others to join us in that fight.
This past Sunday, hundreds of people gathered for an interfaith rally at the Civic Center in Silver Springs, Maryland, to denounce recent incidents of racism and xenophobia. Montgomery County Police Chief Tom Manger brought the voice of local law enforcement.
No matter what happens with the federal government, I can tell you that the Montgomery County Police Department does not care about your immigration status. We care about...
But President-elect Trump has vowed to deport people who are in the U.S. illegally, and Trump has nominated Republican Senator Jeff Sessions to be his attorney general. Sessions has supported expanding deportation and defunding sanctuary cities. For Here and Now, I'm Armando Truhl in Washington, D.C.
And now an update on Will Lautzenheiser. 5 years ago, at the age of 37, he lost both arms and both lower legs to a severe bacterial infection. And remarkably, he took to stand-up comedy, or as he called it, sit-down comedy, as one way to deal with it.
Sometimes I feel like I want to embellish what happened just to make it interesting for me. So I say, this arm was bitten off by a shark when I was surfing. This leg, I got stuck in an elevator door. This arm, I had to eat off that time I was stuck in a mine. And this leg, I lost when I went back to kick the shark that bit my arm off.
At the time, he told us, hey, whatever works. Then we spoke again almost 2 years ago at Will's home in Brookline, Massachusetts, after he received what he called an incredible gift from a deceased donor, a double arm transplant.
Of course, I don't have sensation, and I my own muscle power can move things a little bit. But, we expect that nerves will grow down, and in a year or more, they will be fairly well innervated, and I'll have control over some things and sensation.
So, how's it going? We visited with Will and his partner and caregiver, Angel Gonzalez, again last week. Hi. Are you opening the door?
I am. I can do that now.
Can I have a hug?
You can.
Oh, man.
And it's going to be, it's a little stronger this time than it was last time.
Wow. Angel. Hi, how are you? It's immediately obvious. Will's nerves have grown into the arm. He has control. And I'm watching you speak, and you have a way of speaking, I see now, where you add a little inflection with your hand at the end of every, like you just raise your fingers a little bit at the end of every sentence, and you're doing that.
I think that hands are very expressive, and now that I have them, it's free, so I may as well use my hands to be more emphatic and whatnot.
They just went up on free.
They do it themselves. I don't have to think about it.
So as we catch up here, Angel, when we spoke, you talked about being committed to what you knew was going to be hours every day of helping Will with physical therapy after having helped him hours every day with just the sheer recovery from the initial bacteria. Yeah. From your point of view as caregiver, how has this been?
It's been a lot of work. We're both grateful to the people who have helped us. I mean, we had friends bringing meals for a long time to give me a break, at least for one day or anything. It's really rewarding because now he's taking care of himself in ways that I had to do. And so it's sort of, we have a little bit of more free time to just hang out instead of having to do chores.
Well, also, Will, let's talk about the past 2 years, I think it's been. Yeah, of... The hard work. How much work was it to get to this point?
It's been a lot of work to get to this point. Initially, I was going to the hospital for 4 or 5 hours a day, every day. And that doesn't count all the other labor that we were doing at home just to keep up with the occupational therapy and the exercises that my hands needed in order to maintain their movement and their strength. And really, the hospital appointments for occupational and physical therapy only ended last month or maybe a month and a half ago. So I've been going steadily to appointments all this time for the whole 2 years. And they've been decreasing in frequency. But I feel tethered to the hospital. And it's only very recently that that tether is beginning to stretch out further.
What are some of the things you'd be doing there? I mean, I'm picturing you with weights or so. What are you doing? Yes.
The types of work specifically have been involving grip and trying to develop pinch strength, trying to develop arm strength, muscle strength, and also in terms of physical therapy, that having arms has been very helpful for walking because it helps me maintain a better balance, more my center of gravity is shifted. And so that's also something that we've been working on a lot, just being upright with prostheses. And it's actually kind of mind-blowing how different it is to try to stand upright with prostheses when you have arms versus without them. And it's a lot better now.
Yeah. So, wow, hours every day, this has been your life, working on you, trying to wake these arms up.
I think that's a great way of putting it. Initially, we were treating these arms as newborns and being very tender with them and kind of coddling them a lot. And I think the last time you were here, they were still well wrapped. And it's been 2 years and they're toddler arms now. And they're sort of making their way and it's still a little awkward. It's still clunky. And I don't have fine motor control. I don't know whether that will ever come back. But the things that I can do now are beyond what I imagined that I would be capable of before. And it's taken all that time and that effort in order to get there.
Well, we saw you know, your hand opened the door. You're running the joystick. Angel just said that you can care for yourself, do your own hygiene, yeah. Things like that. What else would you say you're doing?
Well, it's only recently that I've been able to eat without any adaptive device on my hands. So one day, several weeks ago, we were at the ramen restaurant locally, and I forgot my hand splint. And I thought, well, I'll just try, without it. And not only did I get through that meal, but I've never gone back to using a hand splint.
Which you can put a spoon on. It sort of ties a utensil to your hand.
Correct. Yeah. So now I'm just feeding myself without any adaptive device. It's really wonderful.
And there's no truth to the rumor that Angel's been going around the house hiding the adaptive devices.
Yes.
So that you will push yourself. are these arms, are they your arms?
Absolutely. I felt that my own, mental picture of arms mapped onto these very, very soon, almost instantly, I would say. And that just has gotten stronger as the time has gone on. I don't have a proprioceptive sense yet. It's a very deep sense of sort of where my hands are in space. But I can distinguish textures now when I'm feeling a table or versus my skin versus the cloth. Mm-hmm. And I'm surprised at being able to make that distinction. So it's still all new. Mm-hmm. I can feel a drop of rain still on my hands now. And I have to say the first time I felt that and the wind on my knuckles, I just wept because it was so wonderful to feel.
And how often or how do you even think of the donor at this point? Because when we spoke, it was with, a reverence, that you felt almost an obligation to do as his parents asked in their statement, that you hug as many people as possible because he did, and that you recognize how beautiful these arms are and use these arms. Do you still feel him present?
Absolutely. I don't think I'll ever be separated from that sensation. And I still feel an obligation to the donor in a weird way. I still haven't gone back officially to a comedy stage yet because I'm still navigating whether or not it would be acceptable to make a joke about it. I'm aware that they're my arms. They are. And I'm also thinking, I still think of these as a wonderful, beautiful gift.
Well, when we spoke to you last, you also said, you know, maybe I go for the legs, too, a double leg transplant.
Yes. You know, with all the commitment to the arms, I had been thinking lately, well, maybe it's okay to wait on the legs. Maybe I don't need to spend most of my 40s in the hospital or another couple years of rehab. But then about 2 weeks ago, I was transferring to my shower bench and I just had a thought, maybe if we want to revisit that, it might be time to reach out to the doctors and just have a discussion. And oddly, later that day, one of my doctors called and said, we've been thinking about this and maybe you want to reconvene and start having a discussion about it.
Angel, how do you feel about that? That would be several more years of this hard daily work and caregiving. And
it's scary in many ways because he's got arms now. So we're now putting the arms in maybe a compromised position if things don't go well. And we don't want to lose that.
Yeah, to sort of underline some of the risks is if the legs were to reject, not only would I lose more material and my legs would be shorter, but I would potentially cause the arms to reject as well, which would mean I would be back. So that risk is extremely frightening. And I've come so far with the arms. And for me, this surgery was absolutely the right thing. The question of legs is kind of up in the air right now, in part because the surgery is very, very experimental. So the risks are greater. Yet there's something very alluring about the possibility of being restored. And that's, in a way, a hard narrative to just shrug off and say, well, maybe I can just, it's okay, I can live without that. Maybe it's worth the effort. I haven't decided yet.
Our visit with Will Lautzenheiser and his partner and caregiver, Angel Gonzalez. Will lost all his limbs 5 years ago to a severe bacterial infection. His new transplanted arms are doing beautifully. For pictures and our earlier stories, go to hereandnow.org.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron, helping make delicious home-cooked meals by sourcing from artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. Whether it's Japanese ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, you choose from a range of recipes that can be made in 40 minutes or less. Pre-measured ingredients delivered to your door only when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here.
Ethnic Muslims are under attack in Myanmar. Human Rights Watch says the homes of minority Rohingyas are being destroyed by government forces. The military is conducting operations but denies it's targeting civilians. The BBC's Akbar Hussein is on Skype from Bangladesh near the border with Myanmar. And Akbar, you've been speaking to the Rohingyas who fled their homes. What are they telling you?
This is a very pathetic story, what I have seen in last few days. I have been traveling in the area of Teknaf, which is extreme south of Bangladesh and very close to Bangladesh-Myanmar border. And the stories I got from Rohingyas who came across the Myanmar and took shelter in Bangladesh in last 1 week, they say the way they are being persecuted in Myanmar, this is absolutely beyond any description. And hundreds of Rohingyas infiltrated or entered into Bangladesh in last few days. And they said that Myanmar military, they set their houses on fire. Many men were killed. Many women were tortured and raped. Especially Rohingya Muslims are being targeted. That's why they are taking shelter inside Bangladesh. Mm.
Is it retaliation? Because we're seeing that the government is blaming a militant Rohingya group for killing several police officers at border posts last month. Is that what this is about?
So Myanmar government is saying they are taking back, they are doing an anti-insurgency operations against a Rohingya Solidarity Group, who is a rebel group And they are trying to find out the people who are responsible for those attacks. But the thing is that the gross human rights violation, the allegation of gross human rights violation, it has made a huge concern for many people inside Bangladesh. And Rohingya people are saying that the way military is conducting operation in the Rakhine state, they are targeting indiscriminately. It is going on ethnic cleansing, which the Rohingya people are alleging.
Right. So a little bit of context here. There are about 1 million Rohingya in Myanmar. This is the Muslim minority. In the country, it's the Buddhists who are the majority. So when you say ethnic cleansing, that's what you're referring to. But people in Myanmar see them as illegal immigrants from Bangladesh, even though many of them have been living in Myanmar for generations. So where do these people, now refugees, where do they have to go?
Bangladesh government says they can't afford to host any more Rohingyas inside Bangladesh, because this is extremely difficult for Bangladesh to host any more Rohingyas, because the country, Bangladesh, is already struggling with its huge population, with number of 160 million people.
What kind of pressure is there on Aung San Suu Kyi? We remember back in November, last November, Myanmar held its first openly contested elections in 25 years. Aung San Suu Kyi, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, won those elections. She's barred from taking office, but she is considered to be the de facto leader. What kind of role is she playing in this crisis?
Aung San Suu Kyi is being heavily criticized. They say that Aung San Suu Kyi has been awarded with Nobel Peace Prize, but still, Rohingyas are being persecuted. Rohingya Muslims are being persecuted, and she is taking no hard steps or no tough stand against this. That's why she is being hugely criticized by many Bangladeshis. And even Bangladesh government today summoned the Myanmar ambassador in Dhaka and handed over a letter of protest to him, urging Myanmar to resolve the crisis peacefully.
The BBC's Akbar Hussain on the border of Bangladesh and Myanmar. Thanks for keeping an eye on this.
Thank you.
Rodale is one of the largest independent publishers in the country. Magazines like Men's Health, Women's Health, Runner's World, Prevention. Books, Onward by Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz. A catalog, I Love My Rodale Gardening Aprons. And 65 websites worldwide. It's a family-owned business that helped launch the organic movement in 1942 with the magazine Organic Gardening, now Organic Life. So in this week's View from the Top, our conversations with leaders. Maria Rodale, chair and CEO of Rodale Inc., also author of Scratch, Home Cooking for Everyone Made Simple, Fun, and Totally Delicious. Maria, welcome.
Thank you, Robin. It's so nice to be here.
And we mentioned organic gardening became organic life recently. Mm-hmm. And I just think in a sort of a broad brush way, does this reflect how the core thinking of Rodale, when your grandfather founded it, you know, the thinking behind this company has become mainstream?
I often have told people that when my grandfather came up with the idea of organic gardening and farming, if you wanted organic food, you had to grow it yourself. Mm. And now almost any supermarket has a really good selection of organic food. And people are beginning to broaden their idea of what organic is and realize it's important for clothing and for personal care products as well.
Yeah. Well, when I think of it in the past, I think of beautiful covers with maybe seed packets, very earnest, kind of almost Amish, actually, kind of feel to the company. I've been to your campus in Pennsylvania. But how would you describe the brand?
We're a mission-based company that's committed to health and wellness and the environment. We publish all kinds of information for people to help them live a healthier, happier life and have a better relationship with nature, but also with their families and their community.
And yet you're in a cutthroat world when it comes to publishing. There's a 2012 piece in Forbes. Here's a title no one wants to wake up to. What's behind the grumbling at Rodale? There've been a lot of exits. And here's the subtitle. Staffers blame CEO Maria Rodale. Talk about being a granddaughter, a woman in this business and coming in and as you were, you know, shaking things up.
Well, when I became CEO, it was at the deepest, darkest point of the Great Recession. Mm-hmm. And I inherited a company that had not only been managed in a different way completely than what the family had wanted, but also, you know, we have 70 years of legacy and organizational structure. So I had the tough job, as women often do, of cleaning up, fixing things, getting things back in shape into a way that can work. And I was one of the first people in the media industry to make a lot of the kinds of changes and cuts that a lot of my compatriots at other publishing houses are now making. So let's just say I can relate to, you know, what a lot of other women have gone through, but I don't focus on that. I focus on results and getting the job done.
Well, and on making the case for magazines in a time of the internet, you make the case. Why would one buy a magazine when you can get everything you want online faster?
Well, when the internet first exploded, it did really compete with magazines, because magazines used to be the place where you went to find out, to answer your questions, to figure out where to go and what to do. And that has become the domain of the internet. So now magazines have had to evolve to be more inspirational, more surprising, more random. So helping people find things they may not know they were looking for, and then also more visually exciting and more in-depth.
Yeah, but still, you know, you're fighting an undertow that's a pretty tough one of, mm-hmm. you know, people being pulled to online. What else do you have to do? I mean, there was another article just recently about a family meeting to talk about the succession plan. Do you ever think about, let's go public, you know, let's sell it?
Well, I'm third generation, and we have a fourth generation that we're in the process of educating and training to be owners. And part of that is the succession planning process, which any business person has to do, whether they talk about it publicly or not. Unlike my generation, which was kind of, you know, told after the fact, we want to get the next generation involved in figuring out what the best succession plan is. And we're constantly evaluating what all the options are. We are committed and devoted and want to stay private and independent for as long as possible and as long as family is interested in that, and they are interested in that. But, you know, all of our jobs is to constantly be looking at what are all the options and directions that we might take.
Might one of the changes be, I mean, I'm looking at reporting and, for instance, Organic Life. It is not making money for you. You know, how do you sustain that? When that, you know, the organic gardening and now Organic Life, that's really the nut of the company. So how mm-hmm. do you sustain that? Because I know that's one of your babies.
So I have three children and a grandchild. So those are my babies. brands are my business. And we're constantly evaluating the performance of every single one of those brands. And, you know, one of the reasons I got the bad reputation early on and about grumbling was that I'm proven over and over again that I have the courage to make the tough decisions, and I will make them. We believe in trying new things and being creative and launching new things, but we also believe in holding those things to a high standard of performance. And, you know, when they don't work, we make changes. And that's just what we have to do to stay viable as a business.
Wait, you're not going to drop Organic Life, are you? No? Yes?
No.
Okay. How about, are you ever going to put, like, Jennifer Aniston on the cover? Most of the magazine world is celebrity-driven.
Well, you know, we've been doing a lot of testing around celebrities because, you know, for a long time, celebrities really did drive sales on magazines. That's been happening less and less. It's been working less and less. And I think it's a reflection of what's happening in the whole world and where, you know, people, you know, now social media stars are as big as movie and television stars. So we would not be opposed to putting Jennifer Aniston on the cover. I don't think – I can't even remember. Maybe we have. But right now we're doing a lot of testing away from celebrities or putting them on when they're really relevant and have a story to tell that's related to the topic that we're covering.
Well, if she does, she'd have to wear a Rodale apron.
I'm a big apron fan myself.
They're
so
fabulous. Just
thank you.
Really briefly, you are the embodiment of your grandfather's ideals. You write for Huffington Post, and back in 2013, you wrote an open letter to President Obama. You tried to steer him away from any thoughts of bringing troops into Syria to end the conflict there, pointed out wars usually kill people. But you also pointed out that while there had been questions of chemical use in Syria, that there are chemicals and pesticides used every day in the U.S., and you compared them. I mean, you said people are killed maybe more slowly here by those. You know, at the time, some people thought, how can you compare the instantly dead in a bomb strike in Syria with people who might be long-term victims of chemicals here? Do you stand by that?
Well, I obviously do not condone any sort of chemical warfare. Mm. And it's horrible what happened. It's simply tragic and awful. And, I was actually surprised perhaps that my intentions were taken the way that they were taken, because that wasn't my intention.
We should say a lot of people did get it. You know, what you're saying was, we've got an environmental problem here at home. You wanted the president to focus on that.
Yeah. I mean, I think the bottom line is I believe we have a responsibility as human beings to treat each other with deep respect and care. And whether that's in our environment or in our political relationships, it's essential. And, chemicals in the environment, I mean, we are the founding family of organic. These are things that are unregulated in our country to a large extent. In my book, Organic Manifesto, I wrote about triclosan and how it, became all the rage for people to wash their hands basically in pesticides. And just this year, the government now has banned triclosan. Mm. But in the meantime, we've been selling it to people saying, hey, it makes, makes things cleaner and safer, when in fact, it actually makes us sicker and more vulnerable to diseases. So I do not condone chemical warfare of any type. And I think we have to practice what we preach at home as well.
Yeah. Maria Rodale, CEO of Rodale Inc., thank you so much. Great speaking with you.
Thank you.
Okay, time to talk with someone who gets a kick out of being miserable. Jilly Gagneau and Mike McDonald first gave the Choose Your Own Adventure concept a twist with their own book, Choose Your Own Misery, The Office. It placed readers into a mind-numbingly dull office job as they navigate a series of increasingly terrible scenarios. So what could make a person more miserable than a bad office job? Well, the holidays, of course. Jilly Gagneau takes a stab at that with their latest in the series, Choose Your Own Misery, The Holidays. Jilly, welcome back.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Well, let's start with reminding how this works, because a Choose Your Own Adventure book requires some technical expertise, I guess.
Yeah.
This one opens up in the airport. The reader is about to escape for the holidays to some sort of tropical paradise when all of a sudden something starts going very wrong.
Yes, Hurricane Menudo. It made landfall. You really can't avoid it. And it's ruining your tropical getaway. So then you're forced into a decision. What are you going to do if you can't have your perfect holiday away from the holidays? And then things sort of spin out of control from there.
And there are a lot of different options, as there usually are with these types of books. Run through some of the scenarios.
One of my favorite scenarios is you can be either picked up by or pick up a hitchhiker who you are convinced is going to make you into a skin suit, and your decisions from that point forward get more and more out of control and possibly, dubiously legal.
Yeah.
There are options that can lead you into a really bad scenario involving eating days worth of combos, snack crackers.
Like the thing from the vending machine?
Oh, yeah. The thing from the vending machine, which you had 8 packets of on an overnight drive into town and then went straight to church, and your digestion is in trouble, let's say.
Okay.
We'll keep it really adult, and I'm just going to leave it there.
Yeah, we'll move on from that one.
Yeah, exactly. You can end up at your extremely anal retentive sister's house with her terrible children and your ophile husband. There's all kinds of wonderful options that will hopefully be just familiar enough to make you really happy this isn't your family.
Yeah. Well, I ran through about a dozen of them, and I got violently ill in a Jamaican hotel room, and then I got robbed of all my belongings.
Yeah.
I got arrested for stealing a baby Jesus from a nativity scene. And just about every one of them ends up with me breaking up with my girlfriend. So,
but that's probably for the best. She doesn't seem like a real catch in the end. I'm not going to lie.
But where did you get your pessimism from?
Oh, Midwestern upbringing. I think we have a very thin layer of positivity over just that deep-seated sense that the world is out to get you. Or just it's good fodder for humor. I actually love Christmas in a somewhat ludicrous, childish fashion. So this is not my experience of life. It is just a better joke.
Well, I was going to ask you, did any of these bizarre scenarios come about because they've happened to you or maybe a friend that you know?
I mean, the amount of friends who have been turned into skin suits, it's just no, none of these are autobiographical specifically. Although some of the tiny anecdotes that are snuck in between the pages are, and some of the larger scale things that I think makes everyone even people like myself who love the holidays also slightly fear the holidays. Those are personal experience. You know, you love your family and being around them an extended period of time with the stress of the holidays can change that feeling briefly.
Yes. So there, I mean, this is a little bit of a trope that the holidays are awful experiences yes. for everybody. Where do you think that came from? Are we talking about like Home Alone in the 90s or something? Or
just
further
reality
back than that?
Yeah. Or no, I don't know. I think probably Home Alone in the 90s is one of the earlier times that people admitted that it's not all White Christmas. It's not all Bing Crosby songs. I think it is one of those things that it is a cliche because there is such an element of truth for so many people. You love your family, you love the holidays, or maybe it's a really painful time for a lot of reasons, but all of that cheer has to have a dark side underneath it. I think Bad Santa, not actually a favorite of mine. I think it's
the
a
movie.
Little too grim, yeah. But that very accurately portrays this, like, just all the grim that is underpinning all of the cheer that you put out for society at large.
Yeah. These books that you're writing have been inspired, obviously, by the Choose Your Own Adventure series from the 1980s and 90s.
Yeah.
Why do you choose that format? I mean, you could have written this book straight through about one sort of difficult holiday experience, but instead you choose to walk us down many different paths.
I think there's a few reasons. I mean, first and foremost, my co-author Mike McDonald and I loved those books, and we kind of wanted to pay homage to those books that were such a huge part of our childhood. The experience of being in charge of your story was super exciting when you were a kid. If you were a cheater like me, you also got to win. That was great. You didn't
or lose in the case of this book.
Well, yes. I mean, we're updating it for adulthood, obviously, so the losing is a little more prominent. But beyond that, people our age, people currently have such short attention spans and such limited time that giving them a story that you can digest briefly, especially a comedy story, you can have one experience of it on your commute to work and a different one on the way home, or you can leave it alone for weeks and come back to it when you need that moment again. Mm. So it seemed like a way to take books almost into the digital media era where people's attention spans are sort of dictated by social media and all of that. And hopefully hit a chord with people.
Yeah. So. Well, the book is Choose Your Own Misery, The Holidays. The author is Jilly Gagne, along with her co-author, Mike McDonald. Jilly, thank you. Unhappy holidays.
And an unhappy holiday to you, too.
Robin, I think it's time to watch Home Alone again.
Oh, I live it, so.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd, and for Jeremy Hobson.
He lives it, the kid. I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.